Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, January 24th, 2013, and the United States Senate makes some modest changes in the filibuster rule. It reminds me of this old Monty Python sketch.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings.
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit. Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert.
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see.
Well, the United States Senate ranges from argument to abuse. And the Republicans have widely abused the filibuster rule. It's formerly known as the cloture rule. And it requires 60 votes, a supermajority, to end debate and move to a vote on a specific piece of legislation. And the nuclear option, which is when the majority would use its prerogative to change the rules and blow up the filibuster option, the cloture rule, has once again been sidestepped. Now, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, is going to say that he's got this bipartisan agreement that is going to smooth the process in the world's most deliberative body, the United States Senate. And unfortunately, that's a pile of BS. Because the Republicans will continue to game the new rules as they have the old rules. And the level of abuse, 115 times. In the last Congress, the 112th, 137 times in the period before that. It's more than double what Democrats did, and the Republicans often don't bother to actually get up and talk nonstop as the filibuster imagines, as most of us think it should be. No, they do it by remote control. Now, the new rule is a modest change. It says that the majority party, which is now the Democrats, would no longer have to get 60 votes in order for debate on a bill to proceed in certain circumstances. But they have allowed Republicans to offer at least 2 amendments to the bill in question. Now, I don't think that this is really going to make a significant difference. And with the Democratic majority plus the 2 independent senators, Sanders and the new guy from Maine, the former governor, whose name currently escapes me, the Democrats had the opportunity here to make a significant change. And Jeff Merkley, the junior senator from Oregon, who's gotten a lot of praise here recently for his efforts to rein in abuses of our civil liberties, he was leading the charge to reform the rules in a way that would require the minority to work a little harder. For example, it would require 41 votes to continue to debate an issue. Otherwise, it would be cut off and you would go to a vote. And that would have required actually 41 bodies to be there and vote. And that was a real impediment to the abuse of this process. And as I said, the Democrats are going to put this happy face on it, and this is bipartisan, by golly. But it is an invitation to more obstruction from Republicans. And here is a case in point. If you listen on a regular basis, you know that I'm not that fond of California's senior senator, Dianne Feinstein. She's way too conservative, willing to give up our civil liberties, whether it's on wiretapping or the president's authority to kill people at will using drone strikes, just to cite 2 examples. I do agree with Dianne Feinstein. And today she proposed an assault weapons ban. And I recognize that the definition of assault weapons can be gamed, but She has explicitly stated 157 types of semi-automatic weapons that would no longer be legal in the United States. And do I think this will fix the problem entirely? Of course not. But if over time we can reduce access and the total number of killer weapons in this country, then I think we'll be better off. Sportsmen, target shooters, don't need semi-automatic weapons. If you're defending your home from various types of intruders, you don't need a semi-automatic weapon. And the people who claim that we need to be armed so that we can overthrow our government in a bloody revolution are simply kidding themselves. We would be outgunned by the government at every turn. That horse has already left the barn. And so Dianne Feinstein, who supports Harry Reid's milquetoast approach to reform of the filibuster, introduced her legislation, acknowledging that this is a very uphill road. That was her term. And Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, has already said he's not going to work overtime to pass this. He thinks he might be able to get it through the Senate, but not through the House, and so why bother? And by empowering Republicans to obstruct bills like the assault weapons ban from Senator Feinstein, that is almost the certain outcome. And as I said right after the Newtown Massacre, I favor a lot of different forms of tightened regulation on gun ownership and usage. But I'm very pessimistic that we will see significant changes. Sure, there'll be more background checks. Maybe they'll close the gun show loophole. Feinstein's bill also puts a maximum of 10 bullets per clip. I think that's reasonable, but I recognize how difficult it is to pass that in a gun-loving nation like ours. And here's an example. In Southern California, the Fontana Unified School District has bought 14 military-style assault rifles to give to campus cops to protect students and faculty, they say, in the event of a shooter on campus. And they claim all kinds of safeguards. The guns will be stored in locked compartments located throughout the district. They're not going to have these campus cops toting them down the hallway. But the risk of some misuse of these weapons by one of these campus cops, who is not a real law enforcement officer, let's be honest, they're security guards, or by a student or a wacko who finagles a way to access these weapons. And the idea that a shooter comes on campus and the campus cop has time to go to the safe, pull out this gun, and stop the carnage? I'm sorry. It's ridiculous. And as we harden our public facilities, starting with the airports and now our schools, will supermarkets become armed camps in the future? Well, we'll see how far the madness goes. President Obama announced today his nomination of Mary Jo White, a former federal prosecutor who's been a white-collar defense lawyer in the last few years, to be the next chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Sounds good, doesn't it? A former prosecutor. Obama said it's not enough to change the law, referring to the Dodd-Frank tightening of some financial regulations. He said we also need cops on the beat to enforce the law. Well, Mr. President, you didn't allow the law to be enforced the last 4 years. We didn't see a single banker gangster get indicted, much less go to jail. There have been paltry investigations, mostly of low-level borrowers and lenders, not the big fish. And while it's nice that Mary Jo White has a real tough-on-crime prosecutor's reputation, my guess is she will shortly report for oral surgery to have all of those fangs removed so that she can fit into the zeitgeist of Obama's sense of law enforcement on his buddies on Wall Street. Obama also renominated Richard Cordray as director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Cordray had received a recess appointment because they didn't think they could get him confirmed. And now he will face Senate confirmation. And as Obama's Team 2.0 takes shape, John Kerry, who just yesterday was on the panel quizzing Hillary Clinton about Benghazi, he came back before that committee, introduced by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as the next Secretary of State. Isn't that a nice cozy arrangement? Now, John Kerry faces little opposition from his colleagues. His nomination will probably be one of the easiest of the next few weeks and months. But I'm not excited at all. He's a corporatist. He's a big government guy who supported the war in Iraq before he was against it. And I'm very unenthusiastic about this. But I concede that the votes are there and he will be confirmed. A few weeks ago, I linked to Stephen Zunis' website. He's the professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. He wrote a lengthy analysis of John Kerry's career record, which is a strong set of reasons why he should not be our next Secretary of State. Now, the repercussions of Clinton's testimony before the committee yesterday continue. She was feisty, she was emotional, she got personal about attending the arrival of the dead bodies from Benghazi. But she dodged and stonewalled the central question, which was, why did the Obama administration initially try to tell us this was a spontaneous event linked to that lousy anti-Islamic video made in the United States? And I don't know why she can't answer that question. But Juan Cole, who is a professor at the University of Michigan, you can read his commentary on almost a daily basis at juancole.com. He listed 10 reasons, he called them Republican myths on Benghazi, that justify Clinton's anger. And one of the critical points he makes is that, quote, the consulate was amazingly well guarded by some 40 CIA operatives, many of them former special forces. What he's pointing out is the reason why it's not so easy to get information on the Benghazi attack is that a lot of these people were undercover. The operation at the consulate was a CIA front, essentially, or it was a front for the CIA, to put it more properly. And that raises a very interesting set of issues. Also, he says Republicans keep posturing about the need for greater security at our embassies, but they cut funding for it. And Juan Cole actually visited Benghazi last June. He said Benghazi, a city of over a million, is not dominated by al-Qaeda, contrary to what Senator Lindsey Graham has repeatedly said or implied. The city had successful municipal elections just before he arrived last June. The number one vote-getter was a woman professor of statistics at a university. He said while political Islam is a force in Benghazi, only some relatively small groups are militant. And he says, contrary to repeated assertions that it was obvious that terrorist groups were rampaging around the city, they had just essentially formed a civil group to marginalize armed militants, including those allegedly responsible for the events at the embassy on September 11th. So I give Juan Cole credit for being open-minded and offering some counter views. But I still say that the Republicans can smell the cover-up that Hillary Clinton maintained to what is about her final day as U.S. Secretary of State, at least this time around. Also, while I was at Juan Cole's website, I read his comments on Tuesday's election in Israel. And he had some good comments about how this makes it more difficult for Netanyahu to form a government. And this new centrist party may, in fact, have a moderating influence on his treatment of the Palestinians. But here's where Cole gets really candid. He says the scandal is that 4 million Palestinians living under Israeli control could not vote in these elections. They couldn't vote because they are stateless. They're not citizens of any state. And Netanyahu is committed, despite occasional whitewashing of his position in public, to keeping the Palestinians without a state. But Israel controls the air, water, and land of Palestine and dictates Palestinian lives. It's time, he goes on, to stop using the language of military occupation for what Israel is doing to the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. Israel has annexed the Palestinians but is keeping them stateless. There is no other country in the world engaged in so cruel an enterprise. Well put, Professor. Here in the U.S., members of the House Armed Services Committee criticized the Air Force for its handling of the sexual abuse of recruits at San Antonio's Lackland Air Force Base. It's about time. We've been talking about this issue for many months now, and finally, we're starting to see recognition of the widespread problem. We'll see if they continue to confront this very sordid set of issues. Here in California, we from time to time comment on the situation in Oakland, where we have an out-of-control police force and an out-of-control crime problem. Murder occurs almost daily. The citizens rightly fear for their lives. At the same time, they don't respect the law enforcement agency and many of the rank-and-file members of the police department seem to have great contempt for the citizens that they are there to protect. So now they're bringing in a white knight. He is white. He's not a knight. His name is Bratton. And Bratton has been the police chief in Boston, in New York, in Los Angeles. Bill Bratton is his name. And his firm has been hired by the bankrupt city of Oakland for $250,000 to be a consultant. Now, I would rather see Oakland use that money to hire a handful of cops, because their numbers have declined, and so have the number of police stops, and this is very controversial. The signature of Bill Bratton is stop and frisk. And while he was New York City's police commissioner, he took credit for a drop in crime. Homicides down 39%, robberies down 31%, burglaries down by 25%, car thefts down by 36%. But the toll on civil liberties was as extreme. 88% of all people detained under stop and frisk are innocent of any crime. And people of color, Latinos and African Americans, made up close to 90% of those detained by police in New York City. And Oakland has serious and systemic issues. They're not going to change because of stop and frisk. I'm opposed to it because it is profiling of the worst kind. And I think that police already have enough power under probable cause to stop someone they think may be committing a crime or about to. And so I think, again, the underlying issues will be ignored as they look for headline-grabbing ways to reduce crime. In Los Angeles, where they had their own scandal of rogue policing, the Rampart scandal in the 1990s. They're at it again. They acquired a device called Stingray, and I'll explain how it works in a moment. But it was intended to fight terrorism. and it was purchased in 2006 with Department of Homeland Security funds. The grant said it was intended for regional terrorism investigations. But it's been disclosed that at least 21 times they have used this device in ordinary law enforcement activities. That's what we call mission creep, and there's a lot of it occurring under the rubric of a war on terror and the need to keep Americans safe from terrorists. The portable Stingray device impersonates a cell phone tower, electronically fooling all nearby mobile phones, not just the one of the suspect, to send their signals into an LAPD computer. And that signal reveals to police the location of phones in real time. Now, they can get that information from the phone companies, but they consider that to be too much trouble. The problem is that the technology sucks up the data of every cell phone in the area, and these innocent phone owners never know that the police are grabbing their information. And when they go to court for warrants, the LAPD has not been honest with the judges. They use old language from tapping landline phones called pen register trap and trace. And Linda Lai from the ACLU says that calling it pen register trap and trace, she said, is like applying for a search warrant for someone's home and then searching the entire apartment complex. Meanwhile, across the bay from Oakland, San Francisco wrangles with a new scandal. And it shows the double standard, the outright hypocrisy of Mayor Ed Lee. The double standard starts with last year's persecution of newly elected Sheriff Ross Mercurimi. Maybe you heard the story. He got into an argument with his wife on New Year's Day before he was sworn in as sheriff. And when he pled guilty to a misdemeanor to try to make the case go away, he was labeled a domestic violence convict by the mayor and his colleagues. They used a very suspect process through the City Ethics Commission to try to remove him from office, claiming that his spat with his wife was official misconduct. And any objective person can say, well, that doesn't fit the definition. Now we have a crony of the mayor, a guy who he helped recruit. His name is Henry Alvarez. He's African-American. He runs the San Francisco Housing Authority. There is significant evidence that he is an abusive boss. And now there is a lawsuit with specific allegations that Henry Alvarez repeatedly rigged the bidding process for subcontractors at the Housing Authority. And they're claiming he didn't have anything to do with it. It's just accidental that his buddies wound up with the contracts. But the San Francisco Chronicle, to its credit, which backed Mayor Lee in the persecution of Mercurimi, is not backing down in the face of the mayor's studied inaction in these allegations against Alvarez. Now, Alvarez has a contract that runs till later this year. If he completes the contract, he gets a pension. Maybe that's the reason the mayor is soft-pedaling this. But this is obvious official misconduct with multiple allegations. The mayor should suspend this man the way he suspended Ross Mercurimi without pay. Investigate, and take steps to remove him. But that's not how it works in Ed Lee's San Francisco. Thanks for indulging me again today in my news and comment rants and raves. Your comments to me are always welcome. Humble host at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling.